Hello, I am Jay Bartleben. This is number 0280, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0280. But this is a very special edition of the Stuff File Program. Yes, I know, last week we had a special show too, when we put together the annual broadcast of the Meshach and Malik Christmas special, but this show is also rather unique. This is a best of show that looks back at some of the great guests we've been lucky enough to get for this program. There won't be any Stuff File news in this particular edition of the show. It's just going to be snippets of past interviews. We'll also revisit a favorite idiot of the day at the end of the program as well. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0280, was Jay Bartleben, who is the director of programming at CyberStationUSA.com, one of the many places that you can find the Stuff File program. And thank you very much, Jay, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program. Anyway, let's get right to the meat of the show as we look back at some of the interviews done over the past year on the Stuff File program, a show that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Now, back on show number 0229, we spoke with Aaron Murphy. Fans of the classic sitcom Bewitched would recognize the name because between the ages of 2 and 8, Aaron played Samantha and Darren's little girl, Tabitha. This year was the 50th anniversary of that classic show, so it was a good excuse to catch up with Aaron. You have been very, very busy. You've been a model. You've done commercials. You're a teacher, an acting teacher. You've been a television producer, casting director, a motivational speaker. The list goes on and on and on. Would you say you're a type A personality?
I would definitely say that. I think it's like a shark. You have to keep moving or you die.
The show ended when you were 8 years old. But again, you did go on and stay in acting beyond that. We often hear about the pitfalls that children go through as actors. How did you avoid that?
I think you hear about pitfalls that everybody goes through. I think it's a lot more publicized when it's someone famous who gets in trouble for doing something rather than just somebody you went to elementary school with. I think very early on I took responsibility for my own decisions, and I kind of took the idea that I was a role model seriously, and I don't know. I think everything that I have done wrong in my life, I certainly wouldn't blame it on being a child actor.
I've had a chance to talk to several child actors, and they are dividedly into two camps. Now, you have six children, correct?
I do.
So this is the question I always ask. Would you let your kids be child actors?
I would. I've said it for years and years. I said it back when I had only one child. And I always think that as a parent, you kind of support and nurture whatever your kids are interested in. So, I mean, none of my kids have ever said they were interested in acting. I mean, they enjoy the perks of my acting, and they like going to some of the fun events we go to. But I think as a parent, you kind of, I don't know, you guide them to make good decisions, but you kind of let them, you know, make their own path and decide what they want to do.
At the age of two, how did this all begin for you? Did you show an interest in pointing at the television, or were you the kid who drew attention?
I happened to luckily live in California, where everything, you know, was and pretty much is filmed, and everywhere my parents went, people would, you know, approach them and mention and getting agents. And, you know, I have a fraternal twin sister. So back then we were two cute little blonde girls, and people would come up and say, oh, they should be on television. So my parents talked about it and, you know, made an appointment with an agent. And then a week later, I think I booked my first commercial. So I'd done a few commercials, including one with Ronald Reagan before Bewitched. And then they started looking for a Tabitha.
Mm. Now, during the time that you were on that show, they also, if I'm not mistaken, during that time, they also changed Darren's, right?
Yes. I worked 3 years with Dick York and 3 years with Dick Sargent.
What was that like for you at that tender age, all of a sudden this switch of the person who's playing your TV dad?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't my real dad. That would have been more confusing. But Dick York had been sick for a long time. He'd hurt his back early in his career. And, you know, even as a child, I knew that he was in pain. And one day he had a seizure on set. And after that, they had to replace him. They'd done, you know, I think 10 episodes his final season without him, where they kind of rode around the Daring character altogether. And, you know, it got to the point he just couldn't work anymore.
What was it like being the TV daughter of Elizabeth Montgomery?
It was great. Absolutely great. She was a lot of fun. It's funny because her children are still great friends of mine, and I stayed close with her husband, Bill Asher, until he passed away recently. But almost everyone in my life says I'm more like Elizabeth Montgomery even than my own parents. And maybe it's because we spent so much time together on the set, but she was someone I loved and admired very much.
Even though it's 50 years since the show first went on the air, do you still get recognized as Tabitha?
All the time. Shockingly, all the time. And I don't know if it's because I've done things on television since, but I'm recognized almost every day, which is a compliment. I was cute.
From your earliest memories, what was the hardest thing for you to grasp or understand about what you were doing in your role as Tabitha each week?
Actually, that's funny thing is, I think the hardest thing for me to grasp is there were so many episodes where I didn't do very much. It's like, Tabitha, go upstairs to your room. Tabitha, go. I always wanted to do more. So that part was hard for me. I liked when the scripts would come every week and there'd be lots of highlighted parts for me. Those are my favorite weeks.
Actress Erin Murphy, best known as Tabitha on the classic TV series Bewitched. We go from a popular TV child star to one of television's most beloved TV moms. Actress June Lockhart was the matriarch on both Lassie and Lost in Space. But June is much more than that, as we discussed back on show number 0230. She is an actress whose career has spanned an amazing 8 decades, on screen and on stage. She started acting as a little girl with her parents, was signed to a contract as a teen with MGM, and was in such hit movies as Meet Me in St. Louis.
Doing Meet Me in St. Louis was, of course, a joy. As a matter of fact, the interesting thing about that part, it's very rare that in the fourth act of the show, a new character who is introduced, who comes in and solves everybody's problems and gets everybody organized and is introduced as the person who solves the kids' problems. It was quite unusual.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you're also one of television's most beloved moms. You were both in Lassie and in Lost in Space.
And then, of course, I played the lady doctor in Petticoat Junction,
in
which
Petticoat
was a lovely part. And it was such fun to do comedy with those marvelously talented comedic actors.
Well, let's touch on Petticoat Junction for a moment, because that's a situation where you stepped into a role after the lead had unfortunately taken ill.
Yes.
Bea Benaderet.
I think by the time I started to work there, Bea Benaderet had already died.
Yeah.
That's my memory of it, at least. But there again, the producer had been was a friend of mine whom I'd known socially for years. And so when he offered me the role, Lost in Space had just finished, but it was all CBS, all those shows that I did. So it was a lovely happenstance for me to be able to just go into the show, and it was a kind of a seamless change. I just stepped in, and there it was.
So it wasn't
in a completely new character.
I was about to say, it wasn't in any way, shape, or form a difficult situation as opposed
no,
to other shows you did?
Because no, I walked on the set of my first day and called out, "Good morning, everybody!" And they knew we were all off and running and everything was fine.
That's great.
Also, I had never known Bea Benaderet personally. There was no stuff on it in that way, you know?
Now, if I check trivia, is it true that you not only have a Tony, but you have the first Tony?
I have the first Tony for a debut performance, and that was for the 47-48 season of a play in which I made my debut, which was called For Love or Money, and I was 22 at the time.
What do you prefer? Do you prefer the big screen, small screen, or stage?
Well, I like it all. You know, it's all getting out there, learning the lines, rehearsing, and getting out there and doing it. It's really that simple. And I've always enjoyed television, and I was in on the very beginning, of course, of television. I did my first live TV, which was the Ford Theater in 1949, and it was Little Women and the Ford Fireside Theater. And so I may be one of the first actresses to ever participate in a live TV performance of a play like that, who is still living, I must say.
Legendary actress June Lockhart, who was an absolute delight to talk to. Of course, not every guest on the program was a celebrity. As usual, we talked to folks from various walks of life. Back on number 0234, we talked to a woman in New York City who was a professional cuddler. Her name is Allie C., and she started a small business dubbed Cuddle You NYC. She hosts clients in her Manhattan apartment where they come to be spooned and held. One of the things I asked her about was personal safety.
I have a lot of safeguards in place. There's a very strict screening process that my clients go through, which includes giving me profiles to their LinkedIn profile and their Facebook profiles, as well as work information. They also sign a waiver where they understand exactly what is, it helps manage their expectations so they know what is allowed, what isn't. Of course, absolutely no sexual contact of any kind is allowed. I take a photo of their driver's license, and I also have a doorman, and there are cameras in the elevator, so the chance of anybody sneaking in, you know, to take advantage of the situation is... it's non-existent, really. I'm absolutely not worried. There's enough safeguards that I feel totally comfortable. And I'll also tell you that I really get a lot of information from the person. You know, I only progress with scheduling a cuddle. Someone will fill out my new client form, and they'll give me those things that I've asked for, links to their different sites. And then we have a phone conversation. And one of the things that they tell me in their in the new client form is why they're doing this. And most of these reasons have to do with not getting enough nurturing as a child, going through a very stressful period. So I know that their motivations are good. And then after I speak to them on the phone, I have a really clear idea of whether or not I want to work with them. Be mindful that I don't schedule every single person who contacts me. They have to go through my vetting process first.
What does it cost to have a cuddle session?
Well, I wanted to do a few things differently. There are a couple of other professional cuddlers out there, so I wanted to do a few different things. Now, the other cuddlers provide straight cuddles that are based on time, 45 minutes or 60 minutes. I charge $60 for a 45-minute cuddle and $80 for a 60-minute cuddle. But we also do some other things that that can be a little bit more fun and do take more time and do cost more.
Is there conversation during the cuddling? Is it quiet, or does it depend on the client's needs, so to speak?
It absolutely depends on the client's needs. And first of all, let me just set the scene for you. I have a studio apartment, and it is very softly lit. There is soothing music playing. It's a bit like going into a spa. Everything is uncluttered and clean and tidy, and people feel very cozy and at home here. Now, whether or not somebody wants to, so it's a very relaxing environment. Someone can just come and cuddle, or we can talk about things. And because of the inner bonding work that I do, we often do discuss relationship issues, and we try to get to the root of the problem, which is pretty much always based in some sort of childhood trauma that they've experienced.
Do both men and women avail of your services?
Absolutely, yes. And you know, the women clients who I have, we tend to be more focused on the inner bonding. We tend to be more focused on what I call remothering or reparenting, where I'm able to mirror them to them compassionate and loving behavior so that they can then learn how to do this for themselves. It's a way of developing their own loving inner parent. But also there are women who just want to cuddle too. And, you know, they miss having their sisters around, or they miss having their mother around, and they don't have someone to cuddle with. And because it is completely non-sexual, it's a, you know, it works with men and women.
Even though it is, as you say, completely non-sexual, are there people who don't understand it? And by that I mean, I'm sure there are people who come to you who are clients who are not single.
This is true. This is true. I have married clients and clients who are in relationships. And but that doesn't mean they're coming to me because they're looking for something sexual. They often are not, they're often at a crossroads in the relationship, and they are not, it's not that they're not having sex with their partner, it's that they are not experiencing warmth and compassion from their partner. So I kind of help them, in addition to cuddling with them, I kind of walk them through some exercises that they can do to take care of themselves when they are in that position where they feel that their partner is being unloving toward them.
Professional cuddler, Allie C. You'll find her website at cuddlenyc.com. Now back on number 0239, we invited a return guest, former mobster Louis Ferrante. In the past, we talked to him about his two previous books, the last one being Mob Rules. Well, this time around, Louis was back on the show to talk about his new television series called Inside the Gangster's Code, which airs on Discovery. It's a show that takes the audience inside different gang cultures around the world. Discovery came to him to do the show.
When they approached me, they said, "Do you know everything there is to know about prisons?" I said, "I spent 8.5 years in every type of jail you could imagine, medium and high security, penitentiaries, federal, state, county, you name it, I've been there." So, yeah, and I know how it all works inside and out. I had to learn quick in order to survive. And I ended up, when I was in, I got to say, I was a lion in the jungle, you know, because there's no room for, you know, cupcakes in prison. You've got to be the toughest guy if you want to survive, and that's how it's got to be. So, yeah, so that's pretty much how we came across this show together, Discovery Network and myself, and we pulled it off. I mean, we got access to some of the most amazing prisons around the world. First episode that premiered, we visited El Salvador, and it's a country war-torn by civil war. Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives over the years while the country was fighting. And a lot of these kids grew up in this war-torn country with blood and guts all over, and they had to rely on their gang members, their fellow gang members, to survive. And you know, it's become a gang-ridden country. And I locked into a prison with 700 murderers. I got to the shot caller, the guy who calls the shots in the prison, the guy who makes the rules, and I got to the inner workings of his psyche, to ask them what makes them tick, what makes the gang tick, what do they want out of life, what do they do, why do they do this, is there a chance they might stop, do they think they could turn their lives around, do they think he could harness the power of the gang for good, to help society. We went through everything, you name it, we've talked about it, and it's a captivating hour. And, you know, the guys I meet with, I mean, they chop heads off, you know, they're responsible for some of the most heinous crimes in this world, let alone their country, in this entire world. And yet they talk to me. They sit down and talk to me as if I'm a long-lost cousin. I think I break through that barrier with these guys because I lived that life. I walked in their shoes, and I tell them that. I faced life in prison by the age of 26. I had three different indictments, and I was listed as a crew of a boss of my own crew within the Gambino crime family. And I said, I've been there, done that. So, you know, I don't live that way now. I tell them straight out, you're not talking to a gangster anymore. I'm not a gangster. But I have walked in your shoes, and I have been in prison, and I have faced indictments. I have run from the law. I've been on the lam. I've had shootouts with people. You name it, I've done it. So, you know, that I break through to them, you know, where they know they're not just talking to an ordinary journalist. They're talking to somebody who's been there and done that, and they open up to me way more than they would ever open up to any other journalist.
Okay, so you go into these prisons now around the world, some with some of the most heinous criminals that are out there, and you do not fear them. But what about your crew? I mean, you're doing a television show, and I'm just wondering, what's your crew like? Do they ever get afraid in some of the places that you take them?
I'll tell you what, my crew has big stones because I'm the front man. I'm on TV. So, you know, they don't get credit for the things they do. And they're in there with me. You know, almost always, they're right next to me. Very seldom do they do a long shot where they're somewhere protected. 99.9% of the time, my crew is straight in there with me. And let me tell you something, they are courageous people. And never do they wince either. So I've been fortunate. We did Poland, we did El Salvador, we did Italy, we did the Philippines, and we did America. And I had different guys on the crew at times. We interchanged guys that were closer to the locations. And some of the guys were guys I used again and again. But I will tell you this, they are very courageous, men and women, because we had a couple of female producers as well who were extremely courageous. So, you know, I mean, I feel like I've known women who are more courageous than men and men who are more courageous than women. So I don't think gender has anything to do with that. But I do want to point out, I want to emphasize that I had some of the most courageous men and women on my team every step of the way. So I've been fortunate enough, and none of them showed any fear at any time.
Louis Ferrante, host of Inside the Gangster's Code, which airs on Discovery. Louis is always a fascinating and charismatic guest, and proof that someone can turn their life around. There's more Best of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, coming your way in just a moment.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
This is a special edition of the Stuff File program, looking back at snippets of some of the interviews we've done over the past year. Another one of my favorite people to talk to over the years has been actress Dee Wallace. She was on number 0259. Dee has been very, very busy lately. She has a recurring role on NBC's Grimm and another recurring role on ABC's The Whispers, which reunites her with Steven Spielberg for the first time since making E.T. the Extraterrestrial. And if that's not enough, she has two new e-books out. The first one's called Wake Up Now, a book of universal truths. And the second one is Getting Stuff, Everything is Possible. Again, as I said, she's always a joy to talk to right off the bat.
Hello, handsome. How are you?
Thanks. Fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Of course. Happy to be here.
Now, again, as I said, you're just a very, very busy lady. But let's start off with the fact that you just recently signed to work with Steven Spielberg again. How did that come about?
Well, they called and I think, you know, to tell you the truth, they added the part at the last minute. On the pilot, and I was lucky enough to be the first one they thought of, I hope. You never know, you know. And went in and did the little part, and they wanted to keep it in the series. So far, I'm back for another couple, and then we'll see.
What is the role you're playing?
I play Grammy. Yes, I have graduated from E.T.'s mom. to Grammy, you know. I'm always going to be somebody's mother, it seems. That I'm destined in my career, other than the Frighteners, to be the mom all the time. It's okay with me. It works for me.
I know this is a slightly scary story, so are you still the Queen of Scream?
Well, I hope I'll always be the Queen of Scream. I'm not screaming a lot in this one yet. You know, I can't give away a lot about it, but let's just say it's going to be one intense ride for everybody.
Okay. So that's a new show that's coming up. With that coming up, does that mean you won't be doing any more episodes of Grimm?
Oh, I certainly hope not. I actually talked to one of the producers the other day, and she said, oh, absolutely not. You know, we hope you're back, and we want you back, and I certainly hope I'm back. I love my part on Grimm. I feel like you're a real part of the family there. And I would like to tap dance between the two of them. A lot of actors do that these days.
Again, on Grimm, you play a mother, but a mother of a different kind.
Indeed, yes. I turn into one monster, don't I? And, you know, we have no idea what we look like as our species until we actually see it on camera. So I had no idea. I said, really, guys, you had to give me such a pointy chin. Really, you know, and a big pointy nose. I look really witchy. But it's all done with CGI. And of course, they don't have time to, you know, it'd be impossible to do the makeup every episode. So, I was just looking forward to seeing what I actually looked like when I turned. But you know, you really do feel stupid being a cute little perky blonde on the set, turning into these monsters and everybody's laughing, you know. We have a great time on that show. Great cast, great producers. It's a fun ride.
Now, I mentioned that you also have a couple of new books out. We spoke to you the last time you had a book out a couple of years ago now, but now you have two new e-books coming out. Tell us about it, starting off with Wake Up Now, a book of universal truths.
Wake Up Now is a collection of weekly e-blasts that I send out, and a lot of my clients, maybe your listeners don't know, I do a lot of healing work, which is, I know, kind of an oxymoron because I'm a scream queen who is also a healer, but that's who I am. And a lot of my clients said, oh my God, because they're all channeled articles about different things that the universe and the collective consciousness are going through. You should put these together in a book. So I did. And Getting Stuff, the other book that's out, is all channeled information, very easy read, really simple, kind of the way I'm talking now, just really understandable way for anybody to kind of put together everything about the creation process in a really easy to read, simple way.
You worked with Steven Spielberg oh so many years ago on E.T., The Extraterrestrial. You've now come full circle. You're working with Steven again. And in between, you've done so much. Is there anything in your career you haven't done that you'd like to do?
You know, I haven't played a nun. And don't ask me why I want to play a nun. I've always wanted to play a nun. But a challenge nun, a nun that's questioning herself and what she knows and questioning the truth. Got me. Maybe it was an actress in another life, and that's the one I won the Academy Award for. Who knows? But I want to do Broadway. I was talking to my daughter over dinner, and she said, Mom, what are some of the things you've wanted to do in your life that you haven't done? And honestly, I can say that's the only one, is I haven't done Broadway. And I always wanted to do, not for a really long time, but, you know, if I could go into Chicago for 6 weeks, man, I'd love that. If I could play the aunt in Oklahoma, I'd love that. Yeah, just want to do, but I had my kid. I started in the biggest blockbuster of all time. You know, I've written 5 books now. I have to say, most of the dreams that I've had in my life and having my daughter was the biggest one I've done. I mean, how many people can say that, you know?
Actress Dee Wallace, who has done everything and truly appreciates her lot in life. And we as her fans really appreciate her. In addition to her acting, her latest books are entitled Wake Up Now, A Book of Universal Truths, and Getting Stuff, Everything is Possible. Okay, on to show number 0265. On that program, we had yet another return guest, George Karunas. He's a renowned global adventurer, storm chaser, explorer, and television presenter. He documents nature's worst weather conditions, and that's taken him around the world. But recently, he really outdid himself by literally climbing into the mouth of an active volcano in Vanuatu. So I saw the video, and the first thing that came to my mind is, why are you trying to kill your mother?
You know what? That's so funny, because I actually haven't talked to my mother since that video came out. I'm afraid to call her up. I've given her quite a few gray hairs over the years, and I think everyone on the planet has by now pretty much seen this volcano video, and it looks really scary, and it looks really dangerous, and, well, that's because it was.
Okay, now one of the things, you do all this and you go all over the place, and I understand the storm thing because it helps people, it's scientific, but besides the wow factor of what you did, what did you get to learn by being at Vanuatu?
Well, interestingly, it's one of these spots on the planet that very few people have ever had the opportunity to get to. So I was drawn to it. I wanted to go there for 10 years. The opportunity just came up to go there. And what I'm really liking about this is that people are seeing the video and they can't believe their eyes. But really, there are spots like this on Earth. And this sort of mission was less scientific and more an exercise to show people what is out there and get people interested in nature and our planet and things like that. Not necessarily studying and taking gas measurements and things like that. I just wanted to showcase our planet because we spend so much time going from our house to our air-conditioned car to our air-conditioned office. We don't get the chance to appreciate this beautiful gem that we're sitting on sailing through space. And there's some really great spots out there that no one gets to go to.
Now, I kid you not, when I first saw the video, I actually wheeled away from my screen. I really did.
You had a physical reaction.
I had a physical reaction. The scene where you're standing literally at the lip of that boiling volcano, yes. I wheeled back going, whoa.
Mission accomplished then. That's good. I want people to not just look at it. I want their jaw to hit the floor and have that physical reaction. So I take that as a compliment. Standing on that spot, though, was very tricky because it was a 1,200-foot descent down into this crater. That's huge. I compare it to the Empire State Building. It's about the same height. And, that was very difficult to get down there. And when you're on the edge, the heat is so intense. And you see me in that, I look like a baked potato in this in this aluminum suit, right? And it protects me from the heat. And without it, I could only stand in that spot for maybe 4 seconds.
Okay, well, give us an idea. What besides the heat of the volcano? Well, like when you put that suit on, does the suit itself feel hot just away from the volcano?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It doesn't. Aluminum's not very breathable, as you can imagine. So it's the kind of thing that when you wear it, you're walking around or trying to do anything, you trap a lot of your own body heat into the thing. But what it's very good at is reflecting radiant heat. And those suits, they're used for things like firefighters and steel mill workers. So I was able to, I have a couple of these in my basement, believe it or not. I've got tubs with all my different volcano gear and climbing equipment. And one of them is labeled volcano suits. So the problem I ran into there was that the volcano creates a lot of acid rain. The gas cloud that comes out of the volcano, when it rains and passes through that gas cloud, it creates sulfuric acid rain that's really strong. And it actually dissolved the metal on the heat suit.
Wow. Now, has anyone done what you've done? In other words, were you concerned about maybe you've gone too far for what the suit or your crew or anybody else can handle?
No, actually. Interestingly, I was able to team up with some New Zealand volcano experts. These guys are colleagues of mine, guys I've been communicating with for quite some time, Jeff Mackley and Brad Ambrose, and they have been down inside this crater a number of times before. So it's not the first time that this has been done. It's just that this particular instance, it just caught the attention of the world. And very, very few people have been down there, but it was absolutely just, you know, I look at the video and so many people online have been posting comments saying, oh, this is fake. It was done with a green screen. And I'm the guy in the shot. I was there. And to me, it doesn't look real.
Now, one of the other things that concern me, I mean, I'm no scientist, so I don't know the ins and out of, you know, the difference between rock and molten lava and so on and so forth and what rock melts at. When you were standing on the edge, I was always concerned about it crumbling underneath you.
Yes, that was absolutely a concern. That one crazy hero shot where I'm standing there and the lava looks like a waterfall behind me. I'm on this one little rope and I'm standing, leaning over the edge as close to the lava lake as you can humanly get. And the ground is so unstable that it's breaking away under my feet. And I keep having to shift my weight, shuffle around because pieces keep dropping off. And there's a tiny ledge that's below me, right at the edge of the lava lake. I couldn't go down there because the lava kept splashing up onto that ledge continuously and it was breaking away quite frequently. So you could not get any closer without basically swimming in it.
Okay, I will not send this last audio clip to your mother. I'll tell you that right now.
That's too late. Her hair is all gray by now.
No.
It's interesting. My family now is pretty much desensitized so over the years. So I can do pretty much anything, and they barely bat an eye now.
Adventurer George Karunas. His website is furiousearth.com, and you owe it to yourself to go to his site and check out the videos. Of course, you'll find links to all the guests on this program by going to thestufffile.com, going to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0280, and you'll find all of the links. We have more of our special edition of the Stuff File program, a best of retrospective look at some of the interviews we've done over the past year. That's coming up in just a bit.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. It's time to announce our favorite story of the year. It involves a high school science teacher who ate nothing but food from McDonald's for 3 months. Guess what happened? Well, he actually lost 37 pounds. John Cisna let his students create a diet for him that consisted of anything on the McDonald's menu. The diet had to stay under 2,000 calories per day and be within recommended levels of carbohydrates, but he was allowed to eat the burgers the restaurant is famous for. During that time, he also walked 45 minutes a day, 4 to 5 times a week. By the end, his cholesterol had dropped 70 points too. Let's be fair, this experience was a lot different than another guy who made a movie about how much weight he gained by eating at McDonald's. After that movie, many restaurants were sued over their menus, but I like Cisna's approach better. He says we all have choices, and it's our choices that make us gain weight, not McDonald's. Now that's a healthy attitude and a great lesson on personal responsibility. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Stand by. Transmitting sound.
You've got a busy life with a lot going on. So let the Kelly Alexander Show keep you up to date on health and lifestyle trends, education, entertainment, and current events. Our weekly one-hour show provides you with interesting and educational information while also seeing the lighter side of life. We enjoy interviewing celebrities as well as they share their stories of struggle and success. Emmy Award winner Mia Michaels of So You Think You Can Dance, Grammy winner Jody Watley, international singing sensation Taylor Dane, and astronaut Julie Payette have all graciously appeared on our show. Don't forget that we tackle important issues as well, like breast cancer awareness, bullying, and texting while driving. There's never a dull moment on the show, so please make sure to stop by and join us. www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Welcome back to a special year-end edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. This is our year-ender, the best of the Stuff File program, featuring snippets of some of the interviews we had this year. Now, fans of the television series Dallas were happy when the long-running nighttime soap was rebooted a few years back on TNT. But after a 3-season run, the series was canceled. However, fans are trying to get TNT to change its mind and allow Dallas back for a 4th season on the air. A Save Dallas petition is on the website causes.org. Now, on the program 0273 of the Stuff File, we had a chance to talk about this effort with Bobby Ewing himself, actor Patrick Duffy. Were you surprised when the 3rd season came to an end and TNT said, we're pulling the plug?
Well, it's not my first day at the picnic here, so I was a little dismayed, not surprised. I've seen things like this happen. I've been on both sides of this equation a lot. So I know that business decisions are made for a various number of reasons, a lot of which we as actors and fans don't know. But I was dismayed because I thought we were doing a really good show. I don't think we were. I know we were. I'm proud of every single episode. And I assumed erroneously that we had at least one more year because the ratings were doing well enough on TNT. So, you know, when you mentioned that, you know, I'm working hard to save the show, I think the work that I did and everybody else did was the work on camera. We worked as hard as we could to make that show as well crafted a television show as we could possibly do. That was our real work. The work now is being done by the fan base, which is totally astounding to me. And I'm here, you know, as I have been this morning to express my gratitude more than anything for the not just the exuberance but the heartfelt effort that people are making to at least let their voices be heard, their desires to be recognized. And TNT, in my most blue sky scenario, will probably not renew the show once they've canceled it. But apparently there are a few other doors that are slightly ajar. And, you know, if something like this can have an effect, then I am just so grateful for the efforts that they've all made.
Well, it's interesting that you say other doors, because I know that the networks, when they do the ratings, they look at people who watch the show when it airs, and also in the first week because a lot of people have DVRs. And I know I'm guilty of this myself, because I'm a person who, when it came to the new version of Dallas, I liked to binge watch. I like to accumulate 3 or 4 episodes and watch them all at a time. And maybe I didn't show up in the ratings because of something like that. And I'm saying that because maybe a place like Netflix is where Dallas belongs.
Well, interestingly enough, Dallas can be watched on Netflix now. In other words, the already shot episodes, Netflix made a deal, and they are available on Netflix. And that's part of the complication of finding a new home for Dallas, as far as what I've been told, is that there are so many ancillary deals in place that it's not just a matter of popping onto a new network or a cable venue, but the legal ramifications of carrying a deal from Netflix to a new place, or the worldwide syndication rights and who owns what and how to divvy up the pie, makes it extremely difficult. And I think that's part of the big hurdle of getting the show picked up at another venue.
Now, I know you can't tell us this, nor you should if you know the answer, but when cliffhangers take place, like the one that took place just recently with the hopes of a 4th season, do you, as the crew and the actors, do you know where that cliffhanger is going? Should that show come back? Or is it a mystery to you as well?
It's a mystery to us, and quite honestly, I prefer it that way. I don't like being the holder of secrets. I didn't know who shot JR until it aired, and none of the cast members know how this explosion is going to be resolved. And at a lot of times, and I know this for a fact in the early Dallas, even the writers and producers didn't know what they were going to do the following season. But they knew they had 3 to 4 months to hash out the storylines and take everything into consideration. So No, I don't believe, other than Cynthia Sidra and possibly Mike Robbins, really know absolutely how they planned and hopefully still plan on resolving the explosion and the different things. There was even a sister of John Ross dangled out there. So there's a lot of things. I would like to know the resolution to them myself.
One of the things I found interesting with your character this year is Bobby's always been the good guy, but we got to see shades of gray with Bobby. And of course, with those shades of gray were the consequences of those shades of gray. Has it been a fresh new way of seeing Bobby for yourself as the person who's portrayed him all these years?
To me, this was, if anything, the 3 years, and if that's all there is, it's great, if not even greater. But it was nice to see Bobby mature into a completely well-rounded person. And by well-rounded, I mean to see the nicks and scrapes and warts that all human beings have. He was so idealistic, you know, in the first incarnation. And now, Bobby, we started the new series. Bobby was celebrating, I believe, his 60th birthday or 61st birthday or something like that. And he was the patriarch of the family, which allowed me to be, as a character, a lot more patient, but also a lot more human, realizing that idealism has its place, but also you have to do what you have to do. And those were fun things to play around the edges of.
Patrick Duffy, best known as Bobby Ewing on Dallas. He is truly one of the nicest gentlemen you will ever come across. Again, that petition to save the show can be found on causes.org and also on Patrick's website. You'll also find the link at thestufffile.com. Also on program number 0273 was legendary actor Theodore Bickel. He has had an illustrious career that has spanned 75 years, conquering stage, film, literature, and music. The Oscar-nominated, Emmy-winning actor is also the driving force behind the theatrical release of Theodore Bickel, In the Shoes of Shalem Aleichem. And there is also his memoir, simply titled Theo, an Autobiography. When we spoke, I had a chance to gush a little about seeing him on stage myself. You've done shows like Fiddler on the Roof. You've done it both on Broadway. You've done it in a touring company. I actually saw you perform in Fiddler on the Roof when you came to Montreal several years ago. So I want to ask a question about performing both on Broadway and both on tour. Are the audiences different?
Yes, they are and they are not. It depends what you're looking for. If you're looking for the audience reaction, do they react to the same things? Do they laugh at the same places? And are they moved by the same portions of a play? They're alike. They're different because regional differences become evident. There are some people in the South laugh at different places and laugh louder and laugh harder and longer. Jewish audiences tend to laugh at different places, again, because of the familiarity of things, especially when you're talking about a show like Fiddler. There are differences in when the ethnic makeup of the audience is predominantly Jewish, for example. I could tell when I was doing Fiddler, I could tell within the first 8 minutes of the play what percentage of the audience is Jewish.
With a career that, as I said, has spanned 75 years, when you first started acting, did you have a vision or a goal or an idea of where your career has gone? In other words, have you been surprised by the directions your career has taken you in the last 75 years?
Thankfully, yes, I have been surprised. I just set out to be a good performer, a good singer, a good conversationalist, an intellectual, a well-read person. And of course, I'm also a liberal. I come from a socialist home, and my involvement with labor unions and with left-wing politics followed naturally from that. So as a human being, I was involved in causes. As a performer, I branched out into all of the aspects of performing. I started with the theater, which is the most important medium there is. But then I did movies and I did television, and they, each of them demand a different attitude and different technique. And I'm glad to say that I was able to master them to a degree of professionalism and proficiency that proved to be right.
You mentioned that theater is to you is the most important, and you then transitioned into films. Now, one of the things that you are known for is you also originated the role of Captain Von Trapp on Broadway. I've had the opportunity to talk to some other actors about this as well. I'm just curious to know how you feel about the fact that the opportunity didn't come your way to play that in the film.
I really was, for 5 minutes, I was upset about that, naturally. Yeah. But frankly, it wasn't in the cards, because on stage, the star of the play was Mary Martin, and she was exactly 10 years older than I. Which on the stage you can get away with. There was no way that she could play this role in the movie. And since they couldn't take her, they couldn't take me. They're not politics.
You also mentioned the fact that you are politically active as well. And I'm just wondering, especially in this day and age of social media, how would things be different as far as you're concerned? I mean, you've involved yourself in many causes over the years, many controversial causes that sometimes, having a certain notoriety, a certain public forum can be helpful to somebody's getting their point or view across. It could also be damaging to one's own career. Were you ever concerned, being so politically active, that it might hurt you as an actor?
No, I was never concerned. You follow your beliefs wherever they lead you, and consequences be damned. You cannot play games with your own intellectual honesty, and you cannot withdraw. For example, if you see injustices and you fight them, and you tread on some toes fighting those injustices, yeah, your career may suffer, but I would be not true to myself if I would desist from entering the fight.
The amazing Theodore Bekele. His movie is Theodore Bekele in the Shoes of Shalem Aleichem, and his memoir is Theo, an Autobiography. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is number 0280, and you'll find links to Theodore Bekele's sites, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You can also find all the links for every guest that we've done on this special edition of the Stuff File program on that very same page. Now, I did promise that I would give you a favorite idiot of the day to end things off, so let's get right to it. Right now, it's time for our Retro Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Okay, this year, I have to say, picking just one Idiot of the Day has been a little more difficult than it has been in the past, because this year seemed to have such a bumper crop, so I just went with a gut feeling and took the one from 0237, because it really tickled my fancy, so here we go. The robber of a Radio Shack store in Clearwater, Florida, wore a ski mask, but employees still recognized him. He ordered an employee to get on the floor. When she tried to do that, he pepper sprayed her, so then she just simply ran. He tried to taser her, but ended up shocking himself instead, so then he ran. The alleged robber, 20-year-old Andre T. Puskas, is an employee of the store. He was arrested when, several hours later, he arrived back at the store for his scheduled shift. Boy, his boss must be really, really strict. But seriously, why would someone walk into the place they work, attempt an armed robbery, botch the job because he tasered himself, and then later show up for their next shift at the same location, thinking that nobody could possibly recognize him and he wouldn't be caught? Well, one reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this very special edition of the Stuff File program, number 0280. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0280. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I've said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.